Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour has spent over 35 years studying the Arctic. He dangled on the side of a cliff. When a falcon attacked him, he woke up to a shotgun pointed at his head. He's had a chance to observe what's been happening to the Arctic, and it's a story that is disturbing. The central Arctic Ocean, he says, is now ice-free, which could mean that there could be illegal fishing in the central Arctic if there are fish there. We just really don't know. We are already seeing polar bears disappearing. Caribou will continue to disappear. The changes that are coming, he writes in his book, are going to be a lot more drastic than what we see in the scientific literature, because science has to be pretty much 95% sure before it gets into a scientific journal. But he has seen with his own eyes and his dangerous experiences what's going on in the Arctic, and he is the author of Future Arctic, Field Notes from a World on Edge. Edward Struzik is our guest, and Edward has written other books as well about the Arctic. His earlier book was The Big Thaw, Travels in the Melting North, which focused on the effects of climate change on the Canadian Arctic. He's an award-winning writer and photographer, a fellow at the School of Policy Studies, Queen's Institute for Energy and Environmental Policy at Queen's University in Kingston, Canada. He has won many awards for his outstanding contribution to the understanding of science, and he lives in Edmonton, Alberta. Our phone number is 800-486-8655 for you to join us. Email, it's talk@wpr.org. And if you would like to send a message to us on the Facebook page, that's okay. And you can do that at the Kathleen Dunn Show. All contributions are welcome. Edward, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I've never had a chance to speak with somebody who has studied this region, and it's been a dangerous journey, hasn't it?
Well, I guess, you know, when I hear you say, you talk, it probably is, but I never really feel that way when I go up there.
Mm-hmm.
I've been doing it so often, and, you know, generally feel pretty safe, but there are certain moments, as you've listed a few, stand out that make me pause and consider. You know, yeah, they probably were a bit dangerous.
I would imagine. You write that the history of the Arctic tells us it's always been changing. It's just changing a lot faster now because the climate is warming there twice as fast as any place on Earth. Tell us a little bit more about the history, how it's been changing and how this change is different.
Well, you know, I never really understood what the history of the Arctic was until I went up to Axel Heiberg Island in around 2000 and was helping an archaeologist unearth a forest that existed there 45 million years ago. And there was amber spruce cones, there were the evidence of miniature beavers, horses, camels. It was remarkable. That's when I think scientists knew that the Arctic was warm at one point in time, way, way back. But what we've been seeing in the scientific literature and the research over the years is that it was warm for a very, very long time. We saw it on Houghton Crater on Devon Island, where there were hippos and hippo-like animals, rhino-like animals. There were forests there. We had alligators on northern Ellesmere Island. And so really it got cold and warm and cold and warm, but it really wasn't until the last 4 million years that we saw sort of a movement towards extreme cold. And that's when I think most of the prehistoric animals that we now know about in the literature, woolly mammoths and 8-foot-tall beavers, for example, they all disappeared from the Arctic, and we're left with really the specialists, those that were able to withstand those cycles of warming and cold that has occurred in the past 4.5 million years. And the difference between now and then, of course, is that the warming that we're seeing now is really unlike anything that we've seen or that we know about in the past 100 million years. We're driving the change much more quickly now than ever before. So what's unfolding is going to be really interesting, because I'm not sure that many of the specialists that are out there, the polar bears, the peary caribou, the barren ground grizzly bears, will be able to adapt, because they really need time when change takes place.
Mm, it's so sad what you just said. So they were there because they could adapt to the cold, and one sign, obvious sign of what's happening is that the polar bears are thinner and they're disappearing, and bears are disappearing, and they just can't live there anymore.
It's pretty much, you know, polar bears are creatures of the ice, and the ice is disappearing from the southern end of the Arctic range, and so they're having to spend much more time on land where food is fairly scarce. You know, they're 95% of their diet is seals, and it's very difficult to hunt seals when you're not on the sea ice.
Mm-hmm. You start the book, your latest book, with this description of one horrendous storm, which may just be the beginning of many such storms that we're seeing in the Arctic, but also in other parts of this country and other countries on Earth because of the melting. Can you describe that storm?
It was called the Arctic Cyclone of 2012, and I was actually up in the Arctic sailing in through the Northwest Passage in a 42-foot sailboat, and we caught the end of that storm, and it was really the most powerful summer storm on record in the Arctic. And it was the seventh most powerful storm seasonally that the Arctic has ever seen. Normally, the Arctic doesn't get powerful storms in the midsummer time because, really, there's still a lot of ice, and so that moisture that you need to create those cyclones just isn't there. But because the sea ice is melting so rapidly, you're getting this moisture rising, and you get a lot of mixing and all the ingredients for the energy that's needed to drive these storms. And there's actually a scientist at the University of Wisconsin who predicts that we're going to see a lot more powerful storms in the Arctic in the future, which is a bad thing because at the same time sea levels are rising, and those storm surges are going to be able to move inland a lot farther than they already are. And in the last 10 years, we've seen four surges that have gone 30, 35
kilometers.
Oh, my goodness.
Inland. And you say in the book, imagine what would have happened if that had been the case in New Jersey and New York.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we're getting a taste of it in places like New Jersey, New York, and Miami, which, you know, are suffering the consequences of these much more powerful storms and these surges of water that come inland at a time when sea levels are rising. And this is just going to get exacerbated in the future because the glaciers are melting, the ice caps are melting, and we're getting a lot less water locked up to ice, and it's going to result in a lot more rise in sea levels.
How much of the Arctic ice is gone? What part of it is gone?
Well, I think just to correct what you said earlier on, the Central Arctic Ocean, for example, that's that part of the Arctic that nobody owns. It's about 2 million square miles of area. It has always been encased in ice, but in the last 10 years, we've seen it lose about 40% of its ice. And I was just in China, actually, with your ambassador on oceans and with several other experts in the field of fisheries that are now concerned about foreign fishing companies moving into that territory and fishing out the Central Arctic Ocean, just as they did the Central Bering Sea in the 1990s. So there's hope that, you know, we can get a treaty in place or some kind of an agreement to take place where, you know, let's just hold off and see what we've got there before we start exploiting this.
We don't even know if there are fish there, right?
We don't know that there are fish there, but we do know, for example, that in Greenland, they are now fishing for experimental fisheries for fish that never, like, for example, mackerel. The last 2 years, they've had an experimental fishery of 100,000 tons of fish for mackerel that never existed there before. We're also seeing bluefin tuna moving into Greenland waters. And this is really creating opportunities on the one hand because, you know, the Inuit population is a growing population, and their economic opportunities are diminishing. So this is an opportunity, but we first have to understand how many fish really are there before we start fishing.
Hmm. You were in China. How hard is it to breathe in China now?
It's unbelievable.
Is it?
It's extreme. extraordinary. You see the pictures, but only when you're there. Mm. And I took a train from Shanghai to Qingdao, which is, I think, about 600-700 miles. And it was really, you just can't imagine it. It was something like, you know, Cormac McCarthy's Road. You just can't believe that a landscape or an airscape could actually be that polluted. And what was remarkable was that most of the Chinese people that I met really resent this. There's a real desire, you know, to turn back the clock, that we've got to do something about the pollution because it's unlivable.
Mm. When you say the Central Arctic Ocean, nobody owns it. So who can make sure that what happens there is good for the planet? If nobody, I mean, who steps up to the plate here?
Well, you know, I think your ambassador David Bolton is one of the lead players in this, trying to get China, Canada, Norway, Russia to sit at the table and to say, okay, we do have something here, potentially. We're seeing evidence that there are commercial fish moving into that area. We are seeing evidence that polar bears now are starting to migrate into that area along with seals. And maybe we should just come to an agreement and say, let's figure this out. Let's inventory this first. And the reception that he got and others that promoted this meeting got in China was really quite positive. The Chinese are quite interested in the Arctic, not only because of fishing, but because of oil and gas. But I think they also want to be seen as respectable players and want to be involved in whatever the future is. So. Mm-hmm. They seem to be receptive to the idea that, okay, well, maybe we do have a place to start working on something here in the future.
Hmm. Is Canada a respectable player?
You know, Canada's been a laggard, actually.
I know.
For many years, and it's been puzzling because they're going to give up the chair of something called the Arctic Council, which is an intergovernmental group of countries that try to manage the Arctic in a way that ensures its sustainable future. And Canada really just kind of missed the boat, and it's going to be turned over to the United States this year. You know, there are many reasons. I think this government has been very much pro-oil and gas development, which, you know, I guess it's not necessarily a bad thing, but in the last 40 years that I've been covering the Arctic, they have been unable to, not one drop of oil or gas has come south. So I think you've got to ask the question that maybe it's not going to happen, and maybe it shouldn't happen, and maybe we should start worrying about other things, such as caribou populations collapsing. Mm-hmm. I use the analogy, you know, if a cattle rancher lost 80% of their herds, you know, say right across Wyoming and Utah and Montana, it would be a national disaster. But when you have caribou populations, which feed the Inuit and the Dene, the Gwich'in of the Arctic, and their populations drop as much as 90%.
Oh my goodness!
Nobody says anything, and really, you know, this is the food on their table.
Why doesn't anybody say anything? Because they're so removed? Because they don't petition their government?
I think that, you know, I think this is it. The Arctic has been out of sight, out of mind for so long that what happens there, people, you know, down south, you know, and I blame journalists such as myself for really not getting the message out. You know, we focus, you know, mostly on energy issues, but fail to understand that there are other economic issues such as wildlife, which sustain communities. When you look at what the food budget of a family is, 4 or 5 caribou a year, you know, essentially is maybe probably 20% of what they would normally make in a year to ship food north.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the Antarctic. What is it that we did better in the Antarctic as a world community than what we're not doing in the Arctic?
Well, you know, a little over 50 years ago, there was an initiative taken to try to manage the Arctic in a way in which everybody had a little piece of the pie, but there would be, you know, there would be no military involvement. There would be mineral and oil and gas exploitation. And it's worked out fairly well. There are, you know, now signs that maybe it's unraveling a bit. We can't do that for the Arctic because we do have, you know, 3.5 million people that live within the Arctic Circle, and we have several different countries that have their own interests there. But I do think that for a number of different things, we can come to an agreement on things such as commercial fisheries, because, you know, fish travel from one boundary to another fairly freely. So do polar bears. We have an opportunity to, if we're going to promote shipping and oil and gas, that we have to have some way of dealing with an oil spill, which we don't have right now. I think I outline in a book, if there was, you know, a spill in the Arctic, say in the Northwest Passage, and that it in the middle of the summer, and right now we really don't have the icebreaker capability, either Canada or the United States, you know, we could actually be more than a week away from getting any ship in there to deal with it. We could have a situation where the forest fires are so bad in the Yukon and Alaska that most of the airplanes that could be used for oil and gas cleanup would be devoted to fighting fires in Yukon, Alaska. And then you have, say, perhaps a cyclone of 2012 coming that way at the same time, at a time when there are, you know, millions of nesting birds there, and you have polar bears moving in, following narwhal and beluga whales. I mean, it has a recipe for being a catastrophe that would make the Exxon Valdez look like a minor spill.
Yes. And what about the forest fires? There has been an increase in those as well, hasn't there?
There have been some monumental fires in the last decade or so. I think it was in 2003, 2004, was it 4% of Alaska and the Yukon Territory burned up in one summer? Ooh. I remember it well because I was actually on my way up to do a canoe trip and couldn't get down the Alaska Highway or up the Alaska Highway because of forest fires. We just had one here in the Northwest Territories that was probably the worst on record in that part of the world. We had a tundra fire in 2007 that accounted for, I think, around 40% of all the fire that was burned in Alaska that year. And fires are becoming bigger. They're burning bigger, hotter, and faster. And our ability to fight them, I think, is strained because we just don't have the resources to deal with fires that are that large.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour is Edward Struzik. He's the author of Field Notes from a World on the Edge. Future Arctic is the name of the book. He's an award-winning writer and photographer. He has spent 40 years covering the Arctic. He's a fellow at the School of Policy Studies, Queen's Institute for Energy and Environmental Policy at Queen's University in Kingston, and he's won many, many awards for his work. He lives in Edmonton, Alberta, and we're welcoming phone calls. Here is the number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The last 10 years, he writes, have proven that we've seen dramatic increases in forest fires and tundra fires in the Arctic. Beluga whales are getting smaller. Polar bears are getting thinner. We kind of knew that was happening, but we didn't learn about it until after the fact, and I think that's the most worrisome. There are going to be a lot of surprises to come that we're just not prepared for. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls. We're talking about the Arctic this hour of the show, and John in Glendale is our first caller. Hi, John.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Edward. Yeah, I read an article recently, just a short one, about an iceberg that's the size of California that is, they found is slowly melting because of the salt water warming up. And they said in 100 years, there's nothing we can do about it. And that in 100 years, it's going to raise the sea level by 11 feet more than was already forecast, which was about 2 or 3 feet, I think. So it sounds like it's going to be a real disaster. I don't know if you live on the coast, any coastal regions or islands.
Edward.
I haven't read that report, but, you know, we do know that sea levels will rise. I don't know if they're going to rise that much, but if you live in Alaska, western Alaska, or the western Arctic of Canada, or even the eastern part of Arctic Russia, a lot of those places are only about 4 to 6 feet above sea level. And, you know, being coastal communities, they're fishing cultures and sealing cultures, and they live right along the shoreline. And they're losing as much as 20, 30 feet of shoreline each year with each storm because the permafrost is melting and the sea levels are rising. And there are, I think, you know, 60 communities in Alaska, several in Canada, that really in the next 100 years, 50 years, are in danger of falling into the sea. And it's going to be an expensive problem, because at some point, you know, you're either going to have to try to shore those communities up like Miami is trying to do right now, or you're going to have to move those people. Either way, a decision is going to have to be made, you know, sooner rather than later, because you can't wait until communities start collapsing entirely. So it's a real big problem, I think, you know, not just for the Arctic, but, you know, as you mentioned earlier, New Jersey is also vulnerable. Miami is extremely vulnerable. So it's the sea level, the Arctic ice that's melting now is not only going to raise sea levels in the Canadian Arctic and the U.S. Arctic or Arctic Russia, it's going to raise water levels worldwide. And it's going to be a very serious engineering problem at some point to try to shore up these communities, and because you can't move places like Miami.
Right.
And, you know, we looked at moving places like New Orleans, but the costs are just astronomical.
Mm-hmm. When you talk about most governments focusing on driving the economy in whatever way possible without really understanding what the consequences are going to be, going back to China for just a moment, where people are outraged by not being able to breathe, and you indicate that the Chinese government may understand now that what they're doing cannot continue. Are other governments realizing that what they're doing cannot continue?
Well, I think California is right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with the water problem that they've been largely ignoring for a very long time. Right now, you know, the groundwater is almost down to zero. There are no signs of rain to come, and the entire state has got to readjust. You know, there's even now a move afoot to boycott the consumption of almonds, because, you know, almonds, you know, one almond, I think, requires a gallon of water to produce. And California is what produces 80% of the almonds that we eat here in North America. These are big, tough questions, you know, challenges that many governments have to face. And they just become much more expensive and much more troublesome when we ignore them, as we have, as California has, as China has, and I think now as Arctic nations are doing with the Arctic. I think it's best to get on top of the game before you know, you have to deal with the cleanup. And going back again with the Central Bering Sea, where there was it turned out to be a very rich pollock fishery there. But nobody believed the Alaska fishermen at the time when they said, hey, listen, there are foreign fleets in there fishing illegally. Someone's got to do something about it. And by the time Russia, the United States, Norway, and other countries came to a treaty, I think in 1993, to stop fishing, it was too late. And that pollock fishery has never recovered in over 20 years now.
Thanks for the call, John. Dimitri in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hello there.
Hello. Go ahead.
Yeah, I had just kind of a quick question. So just to set the record straight, I'm neither pro or against, so I don't deny climate change. Neither do I support the theory, but my confusion comes with the vast amount of contradictory evidence that is constantly being put out there. And I don't want to just say the right or the left, but scientists on both sides say that either there is climate change it is happening, but whether it's man-made or not. And so when the NOAA has pictures of the ice not melting whatsoever in the Arctic, and you are being there as a firsthand account. I just want to hear kind of how do you reconcile those, especially when you hear different types of evidence that's being put out there by NASA or other sources. Thank you.
Edward.
Well, you know, I think the evidence is pretty clear. There are, you know, as that great documentary film that's out now, say, merchants of doubt that are out there trying to, you know, disseminate information which suggests that it is not warming. The NOAA has consistently shown that the Arctic ice is retreating in summertime. It does come back. You know, there are cold years. It's not a linear thing. As you'll see, as everyone who lives in the eastern part of the United States saw this winter, it was a bloody cold winter. It was a bloody cold winter in eastern Canada as well. And that's going to happen from time to time. But if you look at the trajectory, what's happening over the last 25, 30 years, it has been getting colder. And it's sort of like what I talked about earlier on over what's happened over the last 100 million years, is that, you know, it was warm, and it got cold, and it got warm, but there was a trend. And right now we're seeing a trend to warming that we've never seen before. And I think it's pretty clear that, you know, natural cycles are at play. I don't think you can deny it, because if you look at the last 100 million years when humans were generally not part of the picture, of the climate picture, that was happening. But I don't think there's any doubt that greenhouse gases are contributing to the warming that's taking place. That's pretty clear in my mind. And I think even the mind of the Chinese government, which is actually doing something about it, they're really one of the leaders in solar research right now.
Let's go to Stephen next in Milwaukee. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, I'm sorry that I'm going to have to make it short. I'm at my school. But I'm from Fairbanks, Alaska, just moved to Milwaukee this year, and I'd just like to basically agree with everything Edward's saying. I was up on the North Slope at Point Lonely here in August, and it's a small, small remote location, Alaska, where the dew line used to be. And the ice is, you know, very scarce. There's a lot of pollution. I jumped in the Arctic Ocean, and it is one dirty and very itchy body of water. I was in Fairbanks. I was born in Fairbanks, so I remember the forest fires from 10 years ago. And I was trying out for soccer in my high school, and the sky was orange every single day. And we were running around in the worst pollution you could ever imagine. Mm. And global warming, regardless if it's human or not, or whatever you want to call it, global climate weirding, it is inevitably there. Coastal erosion is a huge problem in western and northern Alaska, and it's not going to go away. So I really appreciate what you're saying, Edward, and good luck. Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks very much for the call. Edward.
Well, I'd have to thank you as well. I think, you know, that what I tried to outline in the book, that it isn't all doom and gloom. You know, there are some species that are going to do well in this new environment that's unfolding, this new Arctic unfolding. The old Arctic is disappearing. Something is replacing it, and I think that it's pretty clear that, say, wood bison that used to live in the Arctic 400 years ago have been reintroduced to the Northwest Territories, Yukon, and Alaska. They appear to be doing extremely well. Muskox will probably do very well. But we're also going to have some losers, such as caribou and probably polar bears at the southern end of their range. But I think there's many things that we can do to perhaps mitigate the damage that's going to be done, and also exploit the opportunities. Because, you know, with the warmth, you know, we're going to have southern animals move north, and that may in some cases be a good thing. The question is we've just got to start thinking about how we're going to manage this new future Arctic, and if we can play a role in shaping it. And I think we can, you know, for example, by reintroducing bison that disappeared 400 years ago and seeing how well they've done. And they've done extremely well. In the Yukon, for example, people oppose the reintroduction of bison. They just didn't like the idea. That was done about 20 years ago. Now it's a great success story because the animals are proliferating to the point where now it's the animal you can hunt in the wintertime. It's become a kind of a social occasion. It puts meat on the table. indigenous people really liked how it's all turned out. And I think so we can do things that are positive. We don't necessarily have to just say, this is someone's fault. I know it is someone's fault, but I think we can move forward. President Obama just expanded the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge wilderness, and he also declared certain parts of the Alaska Arctic, offshore Arctic, off limits to oil and gas. I think we need to see more of this kind of thing happen in the future so that, you know, the changes that do come will be mitigated and to some extent used to the benefit of the people that live there.
But isn't there something terribly unnerving, or how do we put aside the fact that walruses are in such deep trouble, that polar bears may be non-existent 10 or 20 years from now, that killer whales are preying on narwhals and beluga whales throughout the Arctic Ocean? And it seems to me as though it's really upsetting the nature of things. And what does all of that mean?
I think it's really, we're just seeing something that we've never seen in human history. We're seeing essentially the collapse of an ecosystem and an ecosystem taking over. And I think that we can save some aspects of the old system. I don't think that polar bears will disappear entirely. I think they'll be pushed to the very northern reaches of their range. And I think in the mid regions, they can survive if we decide to manage them in a way that, I don't believe in feeding polar bears puppy chow. That's not my idea of their future. But we do this, you know, we do supplementary feeding for animals in various parts of the world. You know, look what conservationists are doing to save the rhino. So I think they're in Africa. I think there are things that we can do. Some of them may not be palatable, but at least we've got to start discussing openly, you know, what are the options? What is it that we can do before things collapse entirely?
Mm-hmm.
Which I think they're going to do. I mean, I shouldn't say entirely, but they are going to collapse. This Arctic that we once knew is disappearing very, very quickly.
Well, that's a pretty profound thing, what you just said. I feel like we can't talk for a while. We need to take that in, don't you? I mean, that really is.
I think it's absolutely, you know, from a scientific point of view, it really is fascinating to see a world changing so dramatically. But at the same time, you know, there are lessons to be learned to what we did, you know, to the Great Plains of North America when we had, you know, bison by the millions roaming the territory, and we could have saved them at one point, but we chose not to. And what would the world now reintroducing bison to game farms? And it's maybe not the same thing, but it's at least a correction to the things that we did in the past.
We go to Steve in Door County next. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how are you? This is a fantastic conversation.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I'm a little bit difficult to hear you, so if I drop out, I'm sorry. I'll try to be quick. I live on Lake Michigan Door County, the peninsula. And I used to be an avid bird hunter, but it's been about 4 years. When I went out there, I moved here about 15 years ago. The water for, I think, 10 years after that was almost record-setting low throughout the bays around Door County. I don't know about Green Bay, but at least Lake Michigan. And then 2-3 years ago, we had very close to being record-breaking snowfalls and ice caps. And last year, not this winter, but the year prior, was extremely, extremely cold. And this past winter, very little snow. It was cold, but it didn't do much for covering the water. So in the past 3 years, I'm going to be guessing that I was told the water finally, after being down 12 to 15 feet, rose almost 3 feet in 2 years. But I was told that was due to the ice cap and the snow, not due to the melting of the ice caps. Are we going to be affected, long story short, by this water rising around the world, or not in the Great Lakes at all?
I think the Great Lakes is a separate story from what's happening in the oceans. I think what we're seeing in the Great Lakes is that your part of the world has been heating up pretty dramatically. We've seen a great deal of evaporation and also a lot of water consumption, which has had an impact on water levels there. I can't speak to be an expert on that. I think what's happening in the oceans is somewhat different in that you've got tremendous amount of water that's locked up in ice right now, in ice caps and glaciers. And once that starts melting, it's going to make ocean levels rise pretty dramatically. You're not going to see it from year to year, but it's, you know, over decade to decade, there's going to be a pronounced rise, and it's going to start affecting low-lying coastal communities in North America and throughout the world. And I think that's a real challenge because, you know, how do you deal with it? It's a huge engineering problem. You can't move 1 million, 2 million people from New Jersey area or from New York or Miami. You've got to figure out a way to deal with it. But also, perhaps we can just, you know, by controlling greenhouse gas emissions, at least slow this melting that's taking place.
Thank you very much, Steve, for the call. What about the mixture of, I want to go back to those storms that are going 20 miles inland. There have been quite a few of them that you mentioned earlier on in the show. What about this mixing of salt water and fresh water? What kinds of problems has that caused now? And if we see more of these storm surges, which you indicate we will, what will that do to the water supply?
Well, fortunately, it's been happening in areas that are not populated by humans, but what it's done is that it is salinated vast areas of delta environments, bird habitat, and essentially killed a lot of tundra vegetation, vast areas of tundra vegetation. I think some of the most vulnerable places, or the scariest part, is in the Yukon Delta, Kuskokwim Glacier Delta in Alaska, which is probably one of the most important bird nesting sanctuaries in the world. Birds come from all over the world to nest there. There are millions of birds. And if you have storm surges that go 30, 40 kilometers inland there, the impact on those nesting birds is going to be profound. And I think that right now, I know that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is working on this to try to figure out who are the winners going to be, or who are they going to? They're probably going to be more losers than winners in a scenario like that. And, you know, realistically, there's not much you can do. There's also the question of, if salt water intrudes so far inland, is it going to have an impact on freshwater fish such as trout?
Mm-hmm.
And you're getting this kind of mixing that takes place in these near coastal lakes that are extremely vulnerable. So I think we're going to see some very big changes occurring there. But at the same time, you're going to have, you know, a mixing taking place in the Arctic Ocean as well, because, you know, we're getting a lot more warmish, fresher Pacific water flowing into the Arctic and really changing the nature of the Arctic Ocean itself.
Edward Struzik is our guest this hour. His book is Future Arctic, Field Notes from a World on the Edge. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. You can leave your thoughts about your response to this show on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go back to phone calls and Cindy in Appleton. Hi, Cindy.
Hello. Well, first of all, let me say that this is just breaking my heart to hear this, and I'm almost literally in tears. But I just wonder how we're going to get the political will when we already have had two states now, Florida and Wisconsin, who are putting gag orders on branches of government not to even talk about global warming. You know, I don't know how we can change things when we're going backwards in this world instead of forwards, and we call ourselves the intelligent species.
Edward.
Well, I have only one recommendation for that, is to vote. That question is often asked here in Canada, where it's pretty much Canada-wide. Our government doesn't allow any scientists to talk about global warming or climate change. Our prime minister refuses to even utter the line climate change when he goes
really?
Up to the Arctic. It's true. It's true. He goes up to the Arctic every year and he talks about sovereignty and security and concern about the Russians, you know, invading our territory, but never talks about climate change. And it's just an ideological difference. And they've got the blinders on, I think largely because in this case it affects the oil and gas industry in investments in the Arctic or future investments in the Arctic, and they've taken that side. I think the only, you know, the only recourse that we have is to get more people talking about it and to force the political parties to discuss it. You know, really, the good thing is that I was despairing that President Obama wouldn't do anything about climate change during his second term, but he has been taking action, which, you know, offers some hope. As I said earlier, expanding the National Wildlife Refuge or the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge wilderness in Alaska and making areas, offshore areas, off limits to oil and gas. I think, you know, we're seeing efforts being made to engage China on climate change issues. So at least it's a start. I mean, it's a woefully slow start, and it's coming far too late in the game. But, you know, all I can say is that you know, we should have more and more people cheerleading this kind of effort so that, you know, other politicians will see that people do care about it.
Thank you, Cindy, for your call. Dave in Madison, hi.
Hello. My question or comments are very much in line with what Cindy just said. So a little bit of my thunder was taken by her, but I'm glad she said what she said. Rhetorically, I've got a question that I'd like to follow up with a couple comments. But, you know, the rhetorical question is, who cares? And I think that you know, there are probably three different ways you can divide the world's population when you ask that question. And number one is, I think, those people who really believe. Number two, people who refuse to believe. And number three, people who just haven't made a decision, right? It doesn't even register on their day-to-day life of things that are important to them. And I think voting is very important to get, you know, the two parties that either don't believe or doesn't register. Well, I think voting is really important for them. You know, you said yourself there that it's been woefully slow. We've been talking about this for 30 years or more. And it really feels like nothing has been done. There's got to be something other than voting every 2 or 4 or 6 years on your local or national politicians to get the ball moving. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Any ideas come to mind, Edward?
Well, I guess, you know, I hearken back to the days when we had a similar, you know, painful debate over acid rain where there was a real pushback from the industry that we couldn't do anything about it. There was no need to do anything about it. And in the end, we did, and I think we pretty much solved that problem in a fairly simple way by just, you know, limiting the amount of sulfur dioxide that we were, you know, pumping into the atmosphere. And many of those lakes that were, you know, fishless for so long are coming back. I think, you know, that's one example. I think the other example we're seeing here, both in Canada and the United States, is that I think there's a certain recognition among the public that Alberta's oil sands, which are right in my backyard, really are a big contributor to the climate change that is taking place and the greenhouse gas emission increases. And public, it was the public, wasn't the politicians, really, that have stalled Keystone, you know, essentially.
Yes, they have.
Obama, that, you know, we don't want this. And in Canada right now, the pipeline companies are trying to find alternatives to get that bitumen to the west coast of Canada. The two pipeline proposals have been stalled. Another one to the east has been stalled. And they are now so desperate, they are actually proposing or looking at the possibility of sending tar sands bitumen through the Arctic. That's how desperate they've become. And it has really little to do with politicians, because in Canada, our prime minister and our premier in Alberta are 100% behind these pipelines. But it was essentially the public response to this mm-hmm. that stalled it. And I really take comfort from that because I think it shows you that when people get mad, politicians have to listen.
I think the same thing happened in the States with President Obama, from what I've read.
I think you're right. I mean, it only takes a certain amount of push before, you know, people respond. And I think that, you know, the two earlier listeners, I've been the same way, and I have friends who feel the same way, as what can we do? But I think, you know, at some point, if you just push hard enough, you can kind of push somebody over the edge. And I think that that the public and a lot of pundits, you know, pushed President Obama into the position where they said, you know, your legacy is at stake, and you've got to start doing something about something that you said you would deal with at the beginning of your presidency. And maybe it's come too late, but at least it's something.
Carl in Verona is next. Hi, Carl.
Hi. I'd like to get your guest's opinion. I've seen reports that methane is bubbling up like crazy from the Arctic Ocean, particularly the East Siberian Arctic Shelf and a couple other areas. And it's an extremely potent greenhouse gas, far more than CO2. And I'd like to just see what your guest thinks about these reports, if they're true or not. If they are true, is this a big game changer? What effect will it have if all this methane, which has been locked up in the clathrates at the bottom of the Arctic Ocean, is now being released?
Oh, it's a big game changer, and I've seen it myself. You know, it's remarkable because, as you know, when you try to describe it to people like me, that, you know, this idea of something invisible rising up that's going to have such a big impact on the environment. But I was with some geologists about 2 or 3 years ago. We went to the Mackenzie Delta, and I was shown in towards the end of winter where methane was bubbling up through the ice in the Arctic Ocean. And the scientists in this case tried to show me an example of how volatile this is, and threw a match on it. And this was actually, it was ice covered and snow covered, and the thing blew up in flames. And then he realized that he couldn't put it out. And they were just, you know, we're throwing things on it, trying to put it out because it kind of looked ridiculous. Here we are setting fire to the snow. And it just shows you just how dense and powerful this methane is. And it is percolating in from the ocean floor and from the thawing permafrost. And, of course, methane is 10 times more potent than carbon dioxide in warming the atmosphere. So I think it is a game changer.
Thanks very much for your call. We go to Jeff in Superior, running short on time, everybody. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, thanks, Kathleen. Yeah, I just wanted to talk about the lifestyle changes and the personal choices we could make. And I believe, for example, we could be recycling our natural resources. We could be driving battery-powered cars. We could use solar power instead of greenhouse, unrenewable energy sources for producing electricity. And I also wanted to share personally that I've chosen not to have children in my life because overpopulation is a problem. And I think we need to make some personal choices, just like the conservation movement did years ago, to preserve our natural resources.
Edward.
I can't argue with you. I think it really is, to some extent, a matter of lifestyle. It's not just corporations that we should be going after, but I think that we can do things differently. And as I think you alluded to, solar power, wind power, geothermal power, all coming into play. And in China, for example, the one thing that I can leave you with is that one of the things that I found very, very eerie was that most of the vehicles that you see on the road in Shanghai, which is 50 million people, are motorcycles. And I couldn't quite put my handle on why there was something so strange about it, because motorcycles here are so obvious because you can hear them before they come, right? They're just so loud.
Yes.
But all of the motorcycles in Shanghai are electric.
Hmm.
Every single one is electric. And, that's a big, big plus for that city, because if you can imagine having 5 million motorcycles spewing out diesel or gas.
Mm-hmm. Edward, I can't think of a conversation that's more important, and thank you so much for being with us and for writing.
Well, thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
Our guest, Edward Struzik. You spell his last name Struzik. And the book is Future Arctic, Field Notes from a World on the Edge. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Thanks for listening, everybody. Leave your comments on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Great conversations ahead. We'll be with you again tomorrow, starting at 1 o'clock.